Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Well, welcome back. Some of you have been absent here for a couple of weeks. Maybe you're back with us this week. The new year is starting. You got plenty of stuff to do. You know, I don't want to be the person to have to harangue you at the start of every year. I'm just not going to do it the whole time. I'm going to remind you once again, it's time. If you're on the Gulf Coast, it's time for starting your tomatoes. It's time for starting your peppers. This is your last chance to get things like broccoli in for spring. You got to get that ready to go now. Cabbage, you got to get it ready to go now. If you're in North Alabama, it's time to get your cabbage and your parsley and your broccoli started. This is the time. We don't have forever. Spring comes early. No, it doesn't come early. It comes when it's supposed to come. It comes when it comes to where you are. And that may not be when it comes at the same time that it comes to Boston. So if you wait for some guy in New York to tell you when spring is here, and many of you do, you missed it. You just flat missed it. Let's get ready. I don't want to harangue you. You call me if you got any questions about it. This is one of those times when I feel like I ought to tell you what I do. Oh, for a living. And I just got to be honest with you. I got to be frank with you about what I do for a living, which is part of it is, thanks to Sean, he's been very nice about it, we have this little Sunday radio show. But, you know, that's just a few hours a week. And most of the rest of the week, I'm working on other things. I do some writing. I have some columns. But also direct a research center. And it's something I started doing. We're now at about our seventh year really being focused on this. We started the program at this research center. Goodness gracious. It was back in 2005, 2006, 2006, 2007. We really began focusing on this research center. As it turns out, gosh, you know, I don't know where I thought I would end up, but I was certainly doing a lot of work in South Alabama. As it turns out, this research center kind of took off in Northeast Alabama, and that's where I spend a lot of my time and do a lot of my work. It's in the center of cave diversity globally. It's in the center of deciduous forest diversity, trees that lose their leaves, probably the center of spring ephemeral wildflower diversity, center of trillium diversity, pretty near the center of sunflower diversity, maybe the center of hickory diversity. We're working on that. We're thinking about that. It's just a really extraordinary place to do work. Any place in Alabama is an extraordinary place to do work. For various reasons, we settled here, and we did the work here because we thought, let me tell you, this is why we did this research center. It's a forest research center. We're creating an outdoor laboratory. It's just like you're building a lab, except you're building it outside. And what we're looking at is every tree, every stem of a tree, everything bigger than 1 centimeter, which is the size of a pencil. Pull a pencil up, look at it in the face. Every stem about the size of a pencil. We're following it. We're doing it over 150 acres, and we're following it for 50 years. We have labeled, we have mapped, we have measured, we have identified, at this point, more than 50, 60,000 stems. We will have about 100,000 stems when we're done. It's a remarkable effort. It's an incredible effort. And we're already learning incredible things. Let me tell you why it's not just an academic exercise to do this. we're already finding out some really important things about Alabama. And here's sort of the bottom line. And here's what Alabama always needs to recognize. And we're pretty well beginning to demonstrate it here. The future of Kentucky, of West Virginia, of New England, of New York, the future of those places is Alabama. Boy, that scared the fool out of those folks up there, you know? And it should. And let me tell you something else. The future of Alabama is New York and Kentucky and maybe Michigan and Pennsylvania. And that ought to scare the fool out of you. Because things are changing. We know that. They've changed before. They're changing again. And we got to figure out how all this is going to shake out. Some really cool things that we're discovering. We've always known that Alabama, well, we didn't always know, but we've been suspicious that Alabama was the center of forest diversity in North America. And you know what? It's now we pretty well can prove that to be true. We now have the data to show that. It's not California. It's not the Northwest. It's not even the Great Smoky Mountains National Park by any stretch. It's really here in Alabama. So we've got, I think some of you may have heard me say this. If you were to hike the entire Appalachian Trail, because you're looking, you want to see all the beautiful trees. And if you were to hike it all the way from North Carolina up to Pennsylvania, Georgia, there you go, take Georgia, North Georgia, all the way up to Pennsylvania, you'd find 12 species of trees, of oaks. And you'd be so impressed. If you were lucky, you would see 12 species of oaks. We got 40 species of oaks in Alabama. We got places in the Red Hills where there's 25 species of oaks on a single hillside. We've got places in northeast Alabama where you would have as many species of oaks in about 40 to 50 acres as you would in 500,000 acres of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. There are 18 species of hickories native globally, about 18, somewhere between 15 and 18. You know, the weird thing is that two-thirds of those species, more than two-thirds of those species, are in Alabama. We got hillsides in northeast Alabama that I think probably, you know, I think it's the center of hickory diversity globally. All these things are really important. And so we end up with questions like, somebody said the other day, or they've been saying all my life, goodness gracious, you've been hearing it too, that American elms, the good old American elms, are gone because they got destroyed by Dutch elm disease. And I'm looking around Alabama and I'm seeing millions of stems of American elm. And one of the things we're discovering is that American elm in Alabama is many things. We had a pretty poor definition, because the only thing we knew about American elm that scientists did on research on American elms came out of places like Pennsylvania, where they don't have a lot of diversity, and they don't even have a lot of diversity within the group of American elms. And so when all the American elms were destroyed by a disease called Dutch elms disease and then elm yellows, they said, oh, this is the end of American elm. And I'm looking at Alabama, and there are elms everywhere. American elms just absolutely everywhere. And now we know that the American elms in Alabama are more genetically diverse and they're distinct from those elms up north. They have the genes that will allow them to survive the future and to replenish the forests up north. That's really important. That's really important. And that's the work we're doing. It's pretty exciting. We've got a new idea where we decided that, you know, it's not just species that matter. It's individuals. And that's a huge lesson. We're going to be talking about that when we come back, talking about what I do. We're also going to be talking about some beautiful things. The broom sedge, the blue stems are absolutely beautiful. I'm glad some folks are taking notice. Thank you. It's beautiful. We have a name to put on it now. Give us a call. Let us know what's going on in your yard. You've got some questions about what you ought to be doing now. You just call us. 251-343-0106. This is a song called Winter.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Let's talk about your garden. Let's talk about some of the things we're doing. Let's talk about why Alabama is important. You know, I just tried to sort of clue you in that what we're really trying to figure out is how do we make sure that we hold on to the things in Alabama that are going to be so important to the rest of the world. And how do we make sure that this forest that we have in Alabama continues to do what it has done for millions of years, which is to share its diversity with the rest of the country? There's another thing we're doing, and I just want to talk about this briefly because it's so interesting. Some of you have heard me say that we made species, and it's true. And Genesis will tell you that. You just go back and read it carefully. Read Genesis 2. And it says, you know, there's this creation out here. But the big guy says, you gotta put a name on it. You got to put a name on it. And here's the problem. We don't always think real carefully before we put names on things because we're lazy. And sometimes we don't think well, and sometimes we just jump to conclusions, and we got all kind of crazy things we do, and we have all... But the species that we see as species are often species that were identified in another place. It's funny. If we had started identifying species here in Alabama rather than in Harvard, we would have had a very different view of North America, and we probably wouldn't even have the same species names. And, you know, scientists are just like people, because they are people. So, you know, I'll go out in the woods with somebody, and they'll say, what do you think of pin oak? And I'll say, well, that all depends on what you mean by pin oak. And they'll take me to what they call a pin oak. And if I'm in one county, it'll be this kind of tree. And if I'm in another county, it'll be that kind of tree. And if I'm in North Alabama, it'll be a completely different tree. A lot of times in North Alabama, what's called pin oak may be water, what we call water oak in South Alabama. And sometimes people in South Alabama call water oak pin oak. But it could be an entirely different set of trees. I don't know what a pin oak is when somebody tells me a pin oak. Scientists are sort of the same way. We get to make it up as we go along. We don't know if other people are calling the same things, and we don't even know if it really represents something really different. So species are really cool, and we love to talk about them. But sometimes they don't really capture what's going on in creation, if you will, in this big, big world. And one of the things we're finding out, and this is important to think about, oh, it's scary to think about, is that sometimes it's not species that are the future. It's not preserving species that preserves our future. It's preserving individuals. That's where the future is, because that's where the change occurs. That's where we find the species that are the creatures, the individuals that are better adapted to the changes that we'll see in the future, to new diseases that we introduce, like these American elms. If you thought that American elm was all identical, and you had this disease come in and it wiped out a bunch of American elms in Pennsylvania, and you said, oh, that's it for American elms, because they're all the same. They're all the same. They're all the same species. And it turned out, wow, they're not all the same. And they didn't respond the same way. And places like Alabama have more individuals with more diversity in them. Whew. And that scares me to death, and that gives me hope for the future. It scares me because I don't think we recognize how important that is, how important those individuals out there are. And so, you know, we fuss about things like the Endangered Species Act, which focuses on species. But boy, we missed the boat. It's not just that we got to preserve species. We now have to start thinking about preserving individuals. Another thing, I'm going to just talk about this for a minute. Chestnut. A lot of people talk about chestnut. We lost American chestnut. It was an incredible tree. Let's talk about what American chestnut looked like. Probably one of the biggest trees in the forest. Could get easily 125 feet tall, 150 feet tall, very long-lived, very rot-resistant, immense trunks, very fire-resistant, too. So it often paired with things like shortleaf and longleaf in fire climax landscapes. And it was all over Alabama. We got barns built from chestnut all over Alabama. Many of those barns are still standing. It's absolutely incredible because the wood was so rot resistant. The nuts were absolutely delicious. They're not like the Chinese chestnuts that we see in people's yards, which are short, squatty trees. Nothing against short and squatty. They're just different. They're different. We lost American chestnut. And, you know, I think the future of American chestnuts, we're always doing crazy things to get American chestnuts back, and they're not working. The future of American chestnuts, I strongly suspect, was in Alabama. And it may be gone, because I can remember chestnuts, and people like, you know, Mr. Dodd remembered it, and he showed them to me, and we talked about it. There were many places in Talladega Forest, in the Red Hills, where chestnuts were still surviving in the 60s and 70s. And you know what happened? We cut them all down. Didn't even stop to think about it. Cut them all down and planted with some kind of clonal, essentially cloned loblolly pine. We've lost a lot of those individuals, and they were really important because we didn't think about it. And those chestnuts may have been the future. May have been the future. I hope they're still out there somewhere. There's still a chance that a few got left. But those are the individuals that will play a huge role in the future. Just something to think about. How important Alabama is. It's what we're doing. It's what we're trying to do. The other thing I have to do is, as Jason has a nice little ditty, harangue me, you ought to take a rope and hang me. I got to harangue you about getting your garden started. This is the time of year. It's what I'm supposed to do. You'll have to let me do it. It's time to get your tomatoes ready. It's time to get your peppers ready. Sean asked me, where am I going to get the pepper and the tomato seeds that I talk about a lot? And let's talk about the different places. I think almost any major tomato catalog is a great place to buy your seeds now. And if you're in South Alabama, you got to do it right away, because this is the time you need to start them if you're going to have them ready to go. And these tomatoes are not going to be available at the Lowdown Depot. It's just not going to happen because they're clueless. about what your growing conditions are and about what you need. So how are you going to get these seeds? Well, there's just, again, I don't have a particular place to get them, but there are lots of catalogs out there that will work for you. Tomato Grower Supply is one. Oh, what's the other? There's another tomato named Tomato Fest is another place that I get seeds from in California. Now, not everything that these tomato, and there's tons of other places. I'm not so high on Burfy and Parks. Their supply is pretty limited, and I wouldn't recommend that. But places that the smaller catalogs actually have more diversity in them. Odd, isn't it? But you can get more different types. Just experiment. But here's the thing. These seeds are out there everywhere. And what you want to focus on, in general, I recommend for tomatoes, grow your big tomatoes if you want to. You can fool with them all you want. But if you really want a productive tomato that's got a lot of flavor, that's going to survive our heat pretty well, you need to focus on the smaller tomatoes, and particularly those from Central America and South America, where tomatoes came from originally before they got to Mexico and North America. We'll talk about that when we get back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay. Lots of interesting questions here from Jerry and Fort Morgan. So we were talking a little bit about tomatoes, and it's time to begin ordering those tomatoes. Let me just say, there's a lot of experimenting we can still do with tomatoes. I have a tomato that I like to experiment with. It's called Santiago, and it's from Tomato Fest. It's an interesting tomato. It looks like a big tomato, except it's smaller. It's got pleats in it. It's really cool. You open it up, it has the most beautiful interior, and it is incredibly productive. Incredibly productive. Incredibly heat tolerant. And there are two reasons why productive and heat tolerant are good things. Let's talk about them real quickly. You got so many bugs. You got stink bugs, and there are plenty of people out there who will testify about stink bugs. If you haven't encountered them, they can do a real number. And it's hard to keep up with them. It is just, you should probably try. I've just about given up mostly, and I've tried to find things that are resistant to the stink bugs because it's really hard. There's a ton of stink bugs out there. And they're the big leaf-footed bugs. There's other kinds. There's marmorated stink bugs now, and even they'll affect your things. They're a problem. And that doesn't include things like worms. Not just tomato hornworms, but tomato worms. And they can do a lot of damage to tomatoes. Now, if you've got one big, beautiful tomato, it may look awful pretty. It might look like something you might buy at the grocery store. And it gets one nip from a stink bug, you could probably lose that tomato, and often you will. So you got five tomatoes on that plant. They're all absolutely beautiful. The stink bug comes in. He's getting three of them. You got two left, and you see what I'm saying? But if you grow those smaller tomatoes, if you have that productivity, it doesn't matter if the stink bugs come in and get three tomatoes, four tomatoes, because you got 50. That's right. You got 50 tomatoes on that vine. And that's the way it is with Santiago. It's bigger than a cherry tomato. I like that very much about it. It's perfectly sliceable. I often slice it and put it on sandwiches. They're smaller slices, but you know, that makes it easier. It's and the flavor is just incredible. It's just delicious. Some of the cherries actually have better flavor, but not much. And I'll put Santiago up against any of the big tomatoes, the biggest tomatoes, because the smaller tomatoes just are generally more flavorful. So Santiago's one. But don't get stuck on Santiago. There are a lot of others out there you should experiment with. One of the things I found about tomatoes that for us is smaller is better. Productive is really important. If you're looking for heat and disease tolerance, and something that'll withstand the hot nights, which is a big problem here, you need to look for some of the varieties that come from places where tomatoes originated, which was often in places with fairly hot nights. Places like Costa Rica and Nicaragua and Guatemala and Honduras, they have some great tomatoes. Now, some of those areas have high mountains where it is, and they're on the Pacific side. They can be a little dry. But generally, those tomatoes from those areas tend to be really productive in our climate. That was one of the reasons why I chose Santiago. I think it's from Guatemala originally, and it has been very productive. But chop around. There are lots of things from the places, tomatoes from Veracruz do very well. Coyote, I guess is how you would say it. Coyote is a yellow tomato from Veracruz. Has a few little flaws. It tends to crack when it gets too humid, but that's typical of tomatoes when it gets too wet. But it's really incredibly productive. And it is very tolerant of this rainfall. And a lot of Mexico, what is it called? Mexico midget is another tomato that a lot of people have been very happy with. There's a lot of other small tomatoes out there. And those smaller tomatoes tend to keep that original Gulf Coast, Mexican Gulf Coast heritage alive, and they can be very good. They're very good to use. So that's what I'm saying. And don't take me saying one catalog or another is gospel. There's a bunch of them out there, and they're fun to look through, and they're fun to think about, and it's fun to read what they say about tomatoes. But keep those things in mind. Smaller tomatoes are generally much more productive. And the tomatoes that come, and they're also much tastier, and the tomatoes that tend to come from humid places do better. I've actually experimented with some Thai tomatoes. They have a distinctive flavor. It's a little sweet in my estimation, but they can do pretty well too. But generally, the tomatoes from Central and South America, they have that good old-fashioned, as we like to say, tomato flavor that old-fashioned tomatoes don't often have. It's really rich, can be both sweet and just a little tart. Really nice, great for cooking with. Yeah. Can you grow those Santiagos in a Taxman bucket? Absolutely. You can grow anything. You can grow those Santiagos anywhere. One of the nice things about the Santiagos is they do seem to be pretty resistant to things like nematodes and other things in the soil. So, yeah, I like them just growing them in a good old tomato bed. If I told you how to make that tomato bed this year, you still have some time. Generally, what I would do, and people in North Alabama have a lot more time to think about it. People in South Alabama have less time, so you're going to have to kind of cheat just a little bit. But what I do is I crack the soil, and then in fall, in summer, late summer and fall, I began dumping just tons of leaves on that tomato bed so that I'm essentially creating a new layer of fresh soil on top. I don't turn those leaves in. I don't stir them in because I want to create a new layer. And things rot very quickly on the Gulf Coast. And I'll end up, if I put 4 feet of leaves, which is easy. I mean, that's one bag of leaves. It's going to molder down to about, 3 to 6 inches of new soil that you can plant your tomatoes directly in. And the good thing about that is that it will shield those tomatoes from a lot of the disease problems like that we often have. And when I create my beds that way, I almost never have a problem with bacterial wilt of tomatoes. When I don't create my beds that way, I almost always have a problem with bacterial wilt. And that's got to do with drainage and a lot of other things. So get those beds ready. If you've got any questions about how to create a tomato bed, you call me. But I also should say, it ain't just about tomatoes. It's about peppers. A lot of us started our peppers. One of the nice things is starting your peppers, particularly things like South American peppers. Get them started in fall when it's easy to germinate those seeds. Just carry them over in a windowsill the best you can. Get ready to plant them out. You're going to have abundant tomatoes. But this is also a great time to start a lot of annual tomatoes, peppers, typical peppers like, even your bells. You really ought to be starting them about now. That's the truth if you're in South Alabama, a little early in North Alabama, but you need to be starting those things now. Too early for eggplants. Too early for that. Don't worry about those guys. And, you know, what are some other things you can be planting? Well, you give me a call if you're interested in it, and we'll talk about it. There you go. The in a Taxman bucket, a lot of you don't remember Taxman, but God, what a great guy. We enjoyed talking with him a lot. He would plant a lot of things in 5-gallon containers because his yard was just as shady as it could be. He had way too many live oaks. And and they weren't even, you know, it's just they can be a nuisance at times. I will tell you. They're a little weedy. Just want to emphasize that. But he would grow things in buckets so he could move them around to find sunlight when he needed it and move them in and out when he needed to. And it's okay to do that. It's a little bit more trouble. If you're going to do it, you need the right kind of soil mix. That's the big thing. And you got to have really good drainage in the bottom. Getting good drainage in the bottom is tricky. But you don't want to retain a lot of water. That's the first thing. Don't put gravel there. That won't work for a lot of different reasons. But you need to put good holes in the bottom so that you don't get any bulk water there. All the bulk water needs to come out. You're still going to end up sort of like a sponge. I borrowed this idea from somebody else, but it's a great way of illustrating it. It's sort of like a sponge. You know, you fill it up with water. You set it out, some of that water is going to drain off. But even after all that water drains off, right, just naturally, you're still going to end up with a lot of water being held in that sponge because the water is like it's magnetized. It's like that sponge is a magnet that holds on to the water particles. So to get rid of those water particles, what you have to do is you have to squeeze the sponge to get the last of those water particles out. That's exactly what happens in a bucket or in a container. So you want to put a lot of holes so that all the water that's in there that can drain out will drain out, but you're still going to hold on to a lot of water, and you can't literally squeeze that water out, can you? Like you could with a sponge. So what you want to use is a mixture that does two things. It allows the water to drain, but it also allows the free exchange of oxygen, because oxygen is the important ingredient here. Plants need, most of all, sunlight, water, and oxygen. We're going to talk about that here in just a minute.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions
All right.
now at 343-0106.
So, there it is. Enough.
Thank you, Steve.
So let's talk a little bit about tomato beds real quickly and tomato soil and soil for containers. What plants need, listen, we think plants need fertilizer. They only need a little bit. It's grease. It's like saying, oh, well, I'm going to run my tractor by greasing the wheels. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, you need some grease for the wheels. Yeah, you need some grease for the engine parts. But that ain't what drives it. What drives that process is sunlight, water, and oxygen working together, and carbon dioxide. And these are things that you can't really bring to you could bring the water. You can make sure the plant gets plenty of sunlight. That's really important. But what about this oxygen and carbon dioxide thing? We got plenty of carbon dioxide in the air now. It's not a problem anymore. And your tomatoes will have plenty of that. What they need is oxygen around the roots. And this is very important. It's very important not just for the tomato roots, but for all the creatures that are important in maintaining conditions underneath the soil. And the more oxygen is available in between the soil particles. Listen, you got to hear me out on this because this is really important. The more there's space between those soil particles, and the more there's oxygen available around those soil particles and a way for carbon dioxide and other gases to escape, just as a side note, the more of that is available, the less problem you're going to have with disease, the better that tomato is going to grow. So how do you get that oxygen around the roots? How do you get the space between the soil particles? You use the right kind of material. If you've got soil that's been in your yard that's been beaten up, beaten down, fertilizer ain't going to help because you don't have the space between the particles that allows water to move through and allows water not to collect and also to come in when it's dry. You don't have the space if your soil's beaten down in the garden. You don't have the space between those particles that allows oxygen and carbon dioxide to circulate freely, which it needs to be able to do. So you got to add organic matter. That's what does it. And if you're putting growing plants in a pot, you don't use dirt out of the yard. You just don't. You could use pure organic matter out of the yard, out of just leaf mold. That might work okay in some cases. But the thing we found that works really well in pots, I didn't find it. It's just people have realized it over a long time. Nurseries around Mobile have realized that if you're going to grow plants in pots around Mobile, you almost always need to have almost pure pine bark mix in your container. And so you want to go to a place that's selling a mix that is predominantly pine bark. Each piece no bigger than your fingernail. Take your small fingernail, okay? Maybe you could have a few pieces in there as big as your thumb. But that's about the size that you want. A few might be a little bigger, but you want it between those two sizes. And generally, you want it to be about 75% pine bark. You could put some other stuff in there. It's not clear that it makes a lot of difference. I'm not sure it does. I've done it both ways. I can't tell a difference, honestly. But let's say you want to put a little peat in there. That's okay. You could do that. But it's better be 75% pine bark. It may be more. And that's what you need to use in those containers because that pine bark allows the water to drain through. There will always be some water retained, but there will also be plenty of oxygen there too. You put regular soil in those containers, and I don't care how many holes you put in the bottom, and you need to put holes in the bottom. There's no question.
you're still going to end up with way too much moisture in your pot because there's not enough space between those soil particles. Let me tell you something else about growing in a container. If you're growing the Taxman way, and I'm not sure how Taxman did this, honestly. I never asked him, and I've been over to his house a couple of times, and I never thought to look. It's better to drill holes, often better to drill holes, not just in the bottom, but around the sides. And it may be better just, if you only did it in one place, it may be better to drill it around the sides at the bottom, just above where the base is. Because a lot of times those 5-gallon containers will sit on a concrete base or some other type of base, and you see the problem? It almost creates like a vacuum that it just the bulk water can't exit at all. So put some around the sides. I find that makes a lot of difference. A lot of times it also probably helps, I suspect it helps, to drill lots of holes around the sides of the container. I know it's going to seem bizarre and crazy, but I think it probably does help because it does allow for better air exchange. There's a lot of air exchange that goes on in a container anyway, and that's okay. But I think it might be better to actually have some holes around up and down the sides of your 5-gallon container. How many? I don't know. Do I have any scientific proof of this? Sort of. We know it works really well with smaller plants, and it's one of the things I look for with smaller plants. The other thing that does is it does a little bit of root pruning. It encourages a little bit of root pruning, and that can be beneficial for your plants. So that's another way of thinking about it. I guess the ideal container might actually be a container that actually has strips of hardware cloth. Say a 5-gallon bucket that was actually halfway made of hardware cloth. Now, I can't structurally figure out how to do this, but it would help a lot because it would keep your roots from wrapping. It just has a lot of benefits. You get some root pruning, you get plenty of oxygen exchange. That's a good thing. So there's this container story. There it is. Let's see. How often do I rotate my tomato beds? Jerry asked. So we're kind of on tomatoes, and that's okay. That's a good thing to be on. You know, Jerry, a lot of people who create this super soil that I'm talking about, they say you don't need to rotate your tomato beds. And effectively, I'm not rotating them on a long basis because I don't have that. I didn't, for example, in my garden in Mobile, I didn't have that much space. So I would go maybe a couple of years before planting tomatoes, but I would always create fresh soil before I did that. I'd maybe skip a year in a bed, maybe skip 2 years in a bed, and then the third year I would come back with some fresh soil and grow tomatoes there. And because tomatoes are so vulnerable to so many funky soil diseases, it would always be the tomatoes that I would create the fresh soil for, preferentially. And then I would grow, after the tomatoes, maybe I would grow beans, or maybe I would grow okra, you see, and then come back to the tomatoes. But in theory, if you created this fresh layer of soil every year, I think it probably doesn't matter as much. And you got to create a nice deep layer. You got to pretty much do it the way I said to do it. There are probably other variations, but you really have to create a deep layer of mold that you don't want to dig in. So rotation becomes a little less important if you're creating that soil, that fresh soil layer every year. So that's the way I do it. And so Jerry's saying, I grow my, Jason's saying, we're going to be back. We'll talk about it. Just getting wound up here. We'll be back for another hour. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
How the weather in the country? How the weather down south? How the weather in the Delta?
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. I think you're gradually getting in the mood. It's an Alabama Sunday morning, I should also say. You're getting in the mood for tomatoes, and that's good. Also getting in the mood about identifying trees, and that's also good. A lot of people are interested in grasses, and that's also good. We're going to try to talk about all those things. And when I say grasses, I mean some people know what I mean. We're talking about our native grasses, not St. Augustine, not centipede, not Bermuda. Bermuda.
You had me going there for a second, Bill. You really did.
Yeah.
Had me scared.
Yeah. No, not that kind of grass either. So, there you go. We're going to talk a little bit about all those things. Don't get too distracted. Let's get back to tomatoes. Let's start with the tomatoes. Well, no, we're going to start here first. Jason sent me, was it Jason? No. Jason did send me this message. It was good. He was saying that when he plants in a container, in a 5-gallon container, one of the things he does is he puts those containers on a 2x4 set about a foot apart so that they'll drain well. And that's one way to do it. Jason, the other way is to put the hole in the side of the container. And that also works pretty well, to drain. It works just about as well as putting the holes in the bottom, in general, I find. But it won't hurt you to put them in the bottom as well. And if you don't want to stack them on those 2x4s, you could do that. Holes around the sides, I think those help. I just don't know how many you would have to put before it really helps. I'll be honest about that. But it's something we don't think about enough. Really, the reason you want this big plastic bucket is not, it's just to sort of structurally hold the bucket up. It would be nice if that's the sides were more open and breathed more. And weren't, and it's not so much the drainage out of the sides as the oxygen exchange, and it keeps that soil from staying too damp because it allows the air to circulate, remove some of that excess moisture that you get in a 5-gallon bucket. So just something to think about. You can experiment. You tell me. Put a lot of holes in your container. I don't know how many holes you can put in it and still have the container stand up. That's an interesting question. Some of you will experiment and figure this out. I don't know how many holes you can put in there before you lose patience. There it is. Rusty, let's talk. So we're on the containers. Let's go there for a second. I'm listening. Tell me what's up.
That is so funny, Bill, because you were procrastinating last weekend talking about birds because I knew this week was going to be tomatoes.
Yeah, that's right.
And I cleaned out my earth boxes. That's what I was going to mention to some of your callers. If they were looking, those earth boxes do tomatoes fantastic. And I experimented. I did one with Shore Acres soil, the mix. I did one with the potting mix that they recommended. So I cleaned them out yesterday. Both grew exactly the same. I put two different types of cuttings in each one. So everything was the same. Yep. Everything grew pretty much the same. But with that Shore Acres, all my roots were like a mat on the top. So it was like perfect air. None of them shot to the bottom for air because they didn't need it. The potting mix, they all shot to the bottom because they were looking for air, even though they had perlite in it and everything else. So if they want for tomato, yes. I mean, I bought them for eggplant and okra, and they did great for me. But I just threw those things out there as an experiment. And I got 5 gallons of tomatoes sitting out here waiting on a buddy to come pick up for his chickens. And they're great for growing. But for Taxman, I actually knew him when I was a kid. And he told the same thing to my dad as he would tell you, Bill, this is what you need to do. And he'd say the same thing to my dad. So,
we missed Tex, man.
I built seven. I got seven self-wicking 5-gallon buckets with one hole in the side, so it wicks up. You can't overfill it, and the top will be covered, so the rain doesn't get in it, just like my earth boxes. And they work fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's something they could look up on YouTube if they want to make a self-wicking 5-gallon bucket.
Yeah, so it sounds like you got a good plan. I mean, it's interesting that when you look at the way roots are distributed in a container, a lot of times the roots could be all the way in the bottom, or they may be not quite in the bottom because it holds on to too much moisture. If you've got roots all the way in the bottom of your container, it probably means they're actually following the water down to the bottom of the container, and it means that that container mix is pretty well drained and is doing okay. If you've got roots distributed throughout the container, that's what you want, really. You want them there at the top. That means there's enough moisture at the top. So it's interesting. I'm really interested in your observations about just the roots at the tops. I'd like to look at that a little bit better. I think Oliver's mix works because it's mostly pine bark. And you want something, if anything, I've taken Oliver's mixture sometimes and I've actually added more pine bark to it, because I thought it could benefit some. I know that his pH is pretty good, and I know he's got just the right amount of other things in there. So I've often added to it, but just basically to give it better drainage, so that those roots, move down into the bottom of the container as well. Wicking can work very well.
And that's what I'm thinking of. Shore Acres was, the roots were more consistent.
Yeah.
But at the top and healthier, and the same plants that were in the potting mix, because they just all bolted to the bottom to get the air, because I think that it was too high in peat, and I think that might have choked them. They were looking for oxygen. That's what I think, because the moisture content was perfect. I think they were actually looking for air.
Yeah. And well,
the A-shore mixture was like perfect. It was nice and airy, and they were just more consistently throughout.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I, you know, it's interesting. A lot of the Lowdown Depot mixes are okay. They're usually about 50. They don't really tell you exactly what's in them, but effectively, I think they're about 50 to 60% some type of pine bark wood mix. And that's okay. I would like to see more. I think they want to make you think you don't have to water them as much, but if you don't have a mix that needs watering occasionally, then you got a mix that's going to stay way too wet. So, yeah. Well, Rusty, it's good to All hear right. from you. Thank you. Report back on how things work this year. And
okay.
And we'll talk a little bit more about containers. Great. Thank you.
All right.
You know, I'm getting some messages from folks who are asking me about the cloth bags. And indeed, I'm using cloth bags more and more. They've got a lot of growing room. They do tend to allow a bit more oxygen exchange around the sides. They have some other downsides. They dry out more quickly. This is nice, but I never have had a problem with a plant in a cloth bag getting overly saturated, and that's really nice. As you get as it gets bigger and bigger, the cloth bags don't support themselves as well, and I discovered that. I thought it would be great to use some cloth bags for my citrus. It made just perfect sense, and they had them in these big sizes, and they weren't that expensive, and I got them. And you know what?
They're way too flimsy. They just don't hold up. So it's almost like you'd have to have a frame to put the cloth bags in. But up to a certain size, the cloth bags work really well. And for smaller plants, I often use those cloth bags. Well, hold on, Blair. We're going to be right back. And a lot of other thoughts from people. We're going to, Jason, I don't drill the holes. I use number two shot. Jason, remind me to tell you a story sometime. All right, we're going to be back.
Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to go.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, Jason got everybody tickled. I don't drill them holes, buddy. I use number two shot, he says, on how to put holes in his containers. Jason, listen, let me tell you this story. So we run this research center, and we have to get, we got these big trees. And the leaves are 80, 100 feet up or more. And we got to get the leaves out of the tops of the trees. And you can't train squirrels to do it, so I tried doing it with a rifle. Some of you will be ashamed that I'm not that good a shot. Trying to knock a leaf off 80 feet up in the top of a tree, it ain't easy. And so I resorted to shotgun. I used number four. That was the perfect size, I decided. Number four shot. A little hard to find, oddly. So use number four shot, and I sent it off to a researcher at University of Missouri, St. Louis, to do some genetic work on the leaves, and she came back and said, boy, you sure do have a lot of bugs eating your leaves. Number four shot works every time. Gets it out of the tree. Yep. So there we go. Lots of interesting things. Thinking about containers, thinking about what makes them work, how to put holes in the sides, how to use cloth bags, which work pretty well. The 5-gallon containers are the thing out there, and they're kind of a thing, and people like using them, and I don't have any problems with it. I do think having holes on the sides around the base is a good idea. Not necessarily in the bottom. That's fine. Put it in the bottom. But also make sure to put some holes around the sides, right just above the bottom. I think that helps. And if you can use a drill, if you want to put more holes around the sides, I think that probably helps a little bit. How big should those holes be? I would say bigger holes, but not so big that they ruin the structure of your thing and that you get plastic everywhere. Anyway, just something to think about. Blair, hold on. Before I go to Blair, I have missed this, and I think it was, I don't remember who sent this to me. Let's see here. Somebody sent me a picture of a tree. Wasn't Jason, I can't remember now who it was, and asked me to identify it. That tree is a mockernut hickory. It's a hickory. You know it's a hickory because it has compound leaves, and because that's a hickory nut. It's a mockernut because I don't see any shagginess on the bark, and it's kind of that squat classic mockernut husk. If you take that nut and if you could smash a bunch of them and put them in a vat of water and boil it for a while, you'd get a nice hickory oil out of it. Mockernut's really kind of sweet. Mockernut, it's got called mockernut because if you're trying to pick it out like you're picking out a pecan, you're going to spend a lot of time. You're going to waste a lot of time and a lot of nut. But put them in some water, boil them. It makes a really nice oil. Mockernut hickories, one of our great species of hickories. We're kind of the center of hickory diversity globally, probably are the center of hickory diversity globally. What am I saying? There you go. Blair. Now I just had to get that out, Blair. But let's talk about your front yard and what you're thinking about.
Sounds good. So I got a wild hare the other day. We had to take down a tree that was about to crush the chicken coop. And the guy asked if there was anything else I wanted him to do. So I had him rip up every single boxwood that was at the front of my house. And the house looks very naked. But I really wanted to do an edible front yard, almost like a food forest front yard. But I just don't really know what would work. And I also want it to be pretty.
Yeah, so goodness gracious. This is going to be so much fun. So, so let's just, let's think about these things. Many of our really nicest fruits are actually quite ornamental. So we just had a discussion. Somebody last week was talking about, it was Jim in Georgetown was saying how pretty his blueberries are this time of year. Blueberries are stunning. They can be really pretty. They can, many of the better tasting blueberries get a little bit tall, but you can use them effectively. Blueberries are an important ingredient in an edible front yard. And so blueberries, you want to put that on your list. Another one that works in full sun is you can use a couple of citrus. And I'm going to say for ornamental citrus, let's use, there are two that I'm going to recommend that would be are really good for the front yard. They don't get too big. Well, one of them doesn't. and you can use it as a shrub. It's kumquat. Kumquats are so much fun. You can use them in so many different ways. There are a lot of different varieties of kumquat out there, and they're basically, just think of them as these beautiful evergreen shrubs with beautiful white flowers that are very fragrant in spring when they bloom. And then in winter, they're covered with this orange ornamental fruit that is actually quite edible. And so you're kind of torn, do I leave the fruit on there because it's so pretty, or do I take it off and use it and eat it? So there's another one. So kumquats, another citrus that I like using for ornament is calamondin orange, which also is a really nice evergreen and has a nice shape. Satsumas you can use in your yard too, and they're really great. They are weeping, so they're going to cover the area. They're not going to be like a typical canopy tree. The limbs are going to kind of come down, and whether you like that or not, you'll have to decide whether you want that in your front yard or not. So we got that. Now, another great one.
Can I interject real quick?
Yeah.
We mostly get afternoon sun rather than, like, there's a little spot that gets some morning sun. It's getting sun right now. But is any of that going to be negatively affected by getting afternoon sun?
Yeah, all of them are going to be fine. I mean, they'll want as much sun as they can possibly get. But I think the afternoon, all of these will do real well with afternoon sun. They're going to tolerate the heat very well. I'm going to tell you another one that'll tolerate the heat very well and that'll do just fine. And that's rosemary. And use rosemary. It's really a great plant. It's really very easy to grow. And it makes a beautiful hedge that you can trim off. And, of course, it's quite edible and you can use it. So there's another ingredient, and it'll get, somewhere between a little more than knee-high if you can trim it and keep it right at knee-high if you like. So all those are good. What else am I missing? Here's another one, and I'll throw it out there. I think persimmons are one of the most, particularly even the Asian persimmons. The Asian persimmons are incredibly beautiful trees.
And what are we doing wrong with
fall colors?
We have two in the front yard right now, and they just seem sad. They haven't really produced very well.
What kind of persimmons are they?
They're Japanese persimmons. They'll get a little bit of fruit, but I think maybe we've only had maybe two pieces of fruit off of the trees in 5 years.
Yeah, so do you know which varieties they are?
I have no idea. My 3-year-old is joining us right now.
Yeah, okay. Well, so ask your 3-year-old if he she knows what variety it is. It would help me. It generally takes about 3 years for a lot of them to come into good production. Can you eat the fruit of this one while it's still hard?
We probably could. We always wait till it softens up a little bit, and it's just incredibly sweet. It's so, so sweet.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. So, I don't know. You'll have to send me some pictures so I can get a better sense. Some of the persimmons take a little longer time to sort of come into their own and start producing. Giambo is one, and when it finally does, it's really wonderful. I would make sure that there's not a lot of competition from grass around the tree. How tall are these trees now? Are they growing healthy?
They're about 6 feet, but there is grass.
Yeah, so they're not growing like they ought to be growing. Let's you hear this little strumming. Hold on.
Yes, sir.
Let me come back and we'll talk a bit more about it.
Okay, thanks.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, let's get back to it. We got business to attend to with Blair. Jim in Georgetown took issue with my saying a little tall, which I must have said about calamondins, which, I mean, they are a little tall compared to, say, hickories. 10 to 12 feet is what a calamondin is going to be. You got to think of it as a smallish dogwood when you plant a calamondin, but they can be very nice, very pretty. Blair, look, we're going to get to your pomegranate here, to your persimmons here, in just a minute, because they're not as big as they should be, and we need to figure out why. But let me also add to your list, pomegranates are great. And don't go with the variety Wonderful, which is what Lowdown Depot sells, and don't do that. Look up on the web. There's a number of places selling, I'm going to forget the varieties, but there's a lot of varieties of pomegranates out there. They're a great traditional Mobile plant. They have beautiful flowers. If you've never seen a pomegranate flower, have you ever seen a pomegranate flower?
I have not.
Blair? Oh, they're stunning. Look them up on the web. They're beautiful. The fruits are beautiful. You want one that's productive. Call me next week. I'm gonna stock up on all the names that I've been trying. There's several less hardy varieties that would do well along the Gulf Coast, and I'm forgetting their names right now. Pomegranate needs a well-drained site, but it's a beautiful, beautiful plant. And I see it in lots of – it's really funny. You go into the old neighborhoods where people didn't go to Lowdown Depot, and they have these old pomegranates in their yard, and they're just beautiful. I hope it's still there, you know, over in the northern part of Mobile, in some of the old yards there. In the fancier yards that have been sort of redeveloped in the older suburbs, they often remove things like these beautiful pomegranates, which is just crazy. But pomegranates are great. Pindo palm, Blair, you got to let me go on for just a minute. Pindo palm, which we used to call jelly palm in Mobile, I love that fruit, and it's a great palm. It's absolutely delicious. Takes a while to get up to size. But it sounds like you got a little bit of time. And pindo palm's a great one, and I really love it. Loquat is great. Every yard should have a beautiful loquat. There's a lot of great cultivars out there, but almost any loquat cultivar, even if it comes from a seed, is going to produce pretty delicious fruit. Do you know loquats pretty well, Blair?
I do. We used to have one a little closer to the street, but it got torn out and ripped up and with progress and, you know.
Grow fast, produce quickly. They're really great. And then bananas. Don't forget bananas to add to this list. We can grow bananas here, and we can actually not just grow the plants, we can actually grow the bananas if you grow the right kind. The variety that I tend to find fruits the best and is easiest to manage is Rajapuri. put it, give it a little bit of protection, and most years it's going to come through with bananas for you just fine. You once you plant one and you put it in the right place, you call me. We'll talk about where to put it. We'll also talk about what you need to do to tend it so that you make sure you get bananas most years. So there's another edible element that is really good and nice. So there's a bunch of them, and that's a lot to play with. And then you can throw in annuals. I'm sorry, I'm going on. But you throw in stuff like basil. Basil is great, and it makes a beautiful annual. It's really nice to trim up in your front yard. It looks good. No one will ever know it's just basil because it's going to look so pretty there. And I like growing basil in a nice row and make a nice little hedge out of it. Oh, that's really, really good. And then you'll be able to tuck in some vegetables and other things around it, too. So that's a lot to start with, right?
That is great. Yes, thank you so much.
So now we have to come back to your persimmon.
I think it's the grass. I'm looking at it right now. It doesn't have any sort of like a barrier around it to keep the grass. It's just kind of all hanging out together.
Yeah, so there's several things going on there. And it could be that at 5 years old, it should be at least 10 feet tall. So it's definitely not grown very much. And that's part of the issue. Is there any possibility it's in a very wet place?
Well, I mean, Reveal is wet, but... You know, the
yes, that's right. It is in a wet place.
The soil is pretty sandy. It drains really well. It doesn't get a ton of sunlight, though, because we have a really big sweet gum tree that kind of blocks a lot of its sun. But I think you're probably onto something with the grass.
No, I think you're onto something with the sweet gum. So the grass is not helping. But the sweet gum is probably the problem. So it's if it's too close to those sweet gums, it's going to need a lot of sunlight. And the sweet gum roots are going to compete with it as well. So I think it may be there in the sweet gum. So you're going to have to watch that. You know, the nice thing about the sweet gum is that it's going to allow light to come underneath it if it's really big. So one thing to think about as you're thinking about, where is my sunlight? And the most important sunlight is your morning light and your afternoon sunlight, not your noonday sunlight. So one of the things you can do is trim up the limbs on that sweet gum so that they're pretty high on the tree. So trim the lower limbs of that sweet gum. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. I see that. It's, this thing's got to be about 60, 70 years old. I think the lowest limb is about 20 feet up, but they all kind of droop down.
They droop down.
Do I need to trim the ones that are kind of hanging down low?
Yes, that's exactly right, because they're the ones that are intercepting your morning sun, I expect, and mm-hmm. some of your afternoon sun as well, right? So and remember, your morning sun's coming up on the horizon, right? So if you can get more of that morning sun, you'll be in better shape. Here's one way to think about pruning that. You don't have to prune the branch all the way back to the trunk. But at least prune off the tips of that branch so that it doesn't have as much energy and that less of the leaves on that branch, those lower branches, get sunlight, it's gonna kind of gradually work that branch is gonna die off anyway. But it dies off slowly without doing a lot of damage. So if you've got a big fat limb and it's growing out of the trunk, and you don't want to leave a big hole in the trunk if you take it all the way back to the trunk, just thin those tips of the branches. And you can send me a picture, and next week we'll talk about how to do that and see if that'll really make a lot of difference. I think that'll help a lot. I will also say the sweet gum is probably competing. The roots of it are probably competing with your persimmon as well. So here's Blair, here's your homework. You got to send me a picture of your front yard
We're not going to try to address everything, but we are going to try to address these persimmons and see what's wrong, because I want those persimmons to do well for you. So send me a picture of your front yard so I can see how it all sort of resides together there, your sweet gum and your persimmons. And let's get those persimmons back in good shape, and let's make sure you get plenty of additional light for your pomegranates and your blueberries and your rosemaries and your loquats and your calamondins and your kumquats and your pendo palm and your bananas.
Sounds good. Yes.
Yeah. All right. All right. So that's your homework. Send me a picture next week. You can just text it, just like you're calling into this number. Just text me some pictures. Do a good job of taking the pictures so I can see things clearly.
Yes,
sir. And let's talk about it next week.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you, Blair. Well, that was fun, isn't it? It's fun to think about what you can do in your yard and in your front yard. And we kind of did this little show last year where we said, oh, let's fool our HOA. Some of you know what an HOA is. Let's see what we can sneak by our HOA, because, you know, all these little rules, these crazy rules, they don't know a plant from a hat rack. And so we figured there's lots of interesting ways to do it, and one of those interesting ways to do it is with things like kumquats, because they're absolutely beautiful and stunning. And if they ever say, well, you can't have edible stuff in your front, you're saying, well, I don't eat it. It's just an ornamental. It's an ornamental kumquat. And it'll be perfectly beautiful. Don't tell your HOA I said that. Blueberries, absolutely beautiful. They may never know that you have blueberries in your front yard because they're so beautiful, and they make such beautiful shrubs. Really incredible. So it's kind of fun. And then pomegranates. What an incredible thing. And, you know, I just think about all these yards I used to ride my bike around in Mobile, and they would have these beautiful pomegranates growing there. And what did we do? I mean, they were old-fashioned double-flowering pomegranates. That's what you would see more than anything else. But, you know, the pomegranates were big in Mobile. They were big in Alabama. I used to go in the Black Belt of Alabama, the fence rows, Papa Joe's and other places up around in Lounsboro and Dallas County. You'd go by there, the fence rows would just be covered in pomegranates that had grown wild along the fence rows. We got rid of them all. It's crazy. I know, it's just crazy. And they were delicious, and they were incredibly fruitful. It's like we forgot that pomegranates were really a part of the Alabama tradition. They're not native, but they grow well here. Pomegranates, don't forget about them. Don't forget about the pendo palms. And for heaven's sakes, all those loquats. And you're not eating the fruit? Come on. Jim in Georgetown, testify about loquats for us, please. They're really great to have. They're really great. So all these great edible things, you can put them in your front yard. Nobody will ever know any better. I mean, there are loquats in front yards everywhere. And the HOA doesn't know any better. And, you know, have fun. It's really fun. Bananas, yeah, I could see HOAs getting all flustered about bananas, but you just tell them it's an ornamental banana. See if that works. We'll be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. We don't have much time. Did I answer all the questions? I hope so. I think I'm caught up, but if I didn't, you just ping me again and remind me.
Put it in a big brown bag for me.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, so we're going to come back to some questions that I overlooked here down below. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Yes, so that is great cocktail conversation, and it really sets you apart, doesn't it? There you go. It is one of the things we're discovering at the Research Center where I work is that individuals matter.
individuals matter as much, in many ways, as much as species. And it's a really important thing to think about. It's a really scary thing to think about. And I am going to encourage more and more people to think about that. Because the future of our planet depends on individuals. And sometimes it takes two individuals. But that's where things happen. There may be a lesson there for people as well. And we'll try to parse that someday. So Dave from Gulf Shores is asking me, you said species is important, of course, but individual is important as well. What about subspecies and varieties? I don't really hear you talk about that much anyhow. Is that just me? Is it variety? So here's an interesting thing. The whole subspecies and variety thing was a way of trying to capture the idea that things mattered beyond just species. And it's a pretty crude way of doing it. It's funny. We don't really have our definition of what a species is. I mean, Dave, you're going to have to talk to me about this. We'll have to get this started earlier in the show. Our idea of what a species is, even our concept of species, is not really perfect. You know, because they had to drill this into you when you were in grammar school or high school, and they said, well, a species is this, this, and this. Well, no, it isn't. It's sort of this, this, and this. And we can sort of determine what species boundaries are based on whether, for example, they are likely to exchange genes or pollen or whatever. But in fact, hybridization between things we call species goes on. There is gene exchange in oaks, even though that cross species boundaries. That isn't really hybridization. There's a whole lot of things going on out there. So, yeah, subspecies was a kind of a crude way of trying to capture it, and it's still useful sometimes, but it's not really perfect. Or do we, great question. At the research center, Bruce asked, are the invasives like popcorn trees or Chinese privet removed are counted in the survey? This is a big debate. And fortunately, we chose an area where we don't have a lot of invasive species. But we occasionally come across some things. And it is my goal to remove every bit of privet I can and every bit of a thing called bush honeysuckle, which you don't see as much in South Alabama, but it's a big problem in limestone areas in North Alabama. Those things are going to get removed, but fortunately there aren't a lot of them. We do have things like ailanthus and princess tree that we have to that we're counting. There's a debate as to whether we remove those or not. That's interesting questions. But right now, one of the cool things about the plot that we chose is it's almost entirely native. Harvard has a plot, and they got a bunch of invasives there. And it makes their plot less valuable, I think. It tells you some things, but maybe not everything you want to know. So who else am I missing here? Clay. Clay's testifying about earth boxes. We're going to have to talk about that a little bit more. Loquats look like baby magnolias, Jim says. I asked him to testify, Jim, at Georgetown. They're quite pretty. We have two, and I wish we had a few more. They're about 7 years old or so. It looks like we're going to get a good harvest this year for the first time. Jim's going to make something out of those loquats. You know he is. Marilyn, I hope we have time to talk about broom sedge. I'm going to try. Let's get a start.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here, and I'm ready to talk about broom sedge.
Oh, great. Well, you know, we had texted a few months back about a lot that I had bought in Point Clear. It's about 6 acres, but 4 acres were vegetative debris site. We've cleared all that. And we're ready to go in and do a meadow of some sort because, you know, it's a wide open expanse and we just wanted that beautiful field look. And we had discussed broom sedge grass, and I was wondering what variety you thought would do well. It's a little bit more upland than wet, but it is partial shade.
All right. So broom sedge is broom sedge, basically, and that's not entirely true, but for your purposes, it is. So you don't go out looking for a cultivar of it. You just go looking for broom sedge on the roadsides. And basically, okay, Nobody's going to be selling broom sedge plants. There will probably be some broom sedge coming in anyway. But here's what you do. And this is a great time, Marilyn. Go out looking on the roadsides for that beautiful orange color, that grass that stands about knee to waist high. And it's this beautiful orange color on these foggy mornings or when it's wet. It just, have you noticed that color? You'll notice it. I'm going to make you notice it.
get as far away from the
centipede suburbs as you possibly can to look for it. They don't have to go far. North Baldwin County, there's still a little bit of God's creation left in North Baldwin County. So you might have to go up to North Baldwin County to see a lot of it. But you'll see a lot of it, this orange stuff, and it's on the roadsides. It's this beautiful grass, these stalks that are just beautiful orange, and it's got seeds on it. And just cut some of those stalks and take it back and throw it around on your ground. I guarantee some of it. It's better to have done it a little bit earlier, but there'll still be plenty of seeds on it. Just cut that, bring it back, throw it around your property, and you're going to get tons of it coming up. It's the best way to get that transition going because it'll keep the Kogon grass out, it'll keep the Bermuda grass out, and it's beautiful. It looks beautiful. So that's the way to get started. I wish people were selling seeds of it, but nobody really is locally.
Have found a couple of online resources. One that's kind of like a native habitat group from Hartzell. I believe that they have some seeds by the pound.
Yeah, and I know those folks, and that's fine, but that's North Alabama broom sedge, and you're a long way away. They're as far from you as they are from Ohio. So it's a long way up there, believe me. I made the trip many times. And I know those folks and they're just fine, but they really are about the Tennessee Valley. And so I would say, and unfortunately we don't have people doing that down here, but I would say look for some local strains, and they're really out there. The good thing is once you get a little bit of broom sedge in there, you're going to get a lot within a couple of years.
Okay. All right. That sounds fantastic. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, yes. And, oh, listen to that. They're cutting me off. Jerry, we'll talk about burning next week. Listen, Marilyn, we're going to talk more about broom sedge and how to find it, how to get it. I'm going to talk to Sean about this, and we're going to see if we can't find some places where it's more easily collectible. We want to use the local stuff. Well, that was a busy morning. Hope we'll hear more from you next week. Give us a call.